Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. They never go home. They never go home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
When the United States soccer team pulled off one of the all-time World Cup shocks by beating England by a goal to nil in Brazil in 1950, the newspapers in the UK were so incredulous that the people working there assumed some sort of a typo must have occurred in the reports filtering back from Belo Horizonte. And instead of a 1-0 defeat, the media reported it, lamestream media, Murph the Lion media, reported it as a 10-1 victory for Walter Winterbottom's men. That's not an easy one to say. I was stuck on a train watching Leinster Northampton on Saturday evening, Murph.
Oh, yes.
Wrestling with an extremely spotty Wi-Fi connection.
That's Irish Rail for you.
Yeah, well, listen, I don't know. I can't say. I was told it was rock solid. I was told by people, you'll have no problem watching the game. It's a really good Wi-Fi connection. I've talked to people who've worked on trains. It's fine. Well, maybe it is if you're typing away or surfing. But when you're looking for, listen, I'm not here to apportion blame. I'm here to say that at some point after James Lowe, it's a frustrating experience trying to watch a match.
It is. Way.
And at some point after
buffering,
after James Lowe, so much buffering. After Lowe had, not even buffering, just freezing. You know?
Oh, God.
Yeah, freezing, then having to X out of it entirely, come back, turn your connection off, back on, start again. After Lowe had scored his third try, I gave up and I closed the laptop, safe in the knowledge that Leinster were cruising into the final of the Champions Cup, 20 points to 3 ahead, completely untroubled at this stage by anything Northampton had thrown at them, which wasn't very much at all, to be fair. When I later checked the final score and saw that Leinster had scraped through a nail-biter by 20 points to 17, I think you know where you're going, Murph, where I'm going. I'm ashamed to say my initial reaction was a little bit like those British newspaper sports editors in 1950. For a second or two, I just simply refused to believe Leinster had nearly blown it. I assumed there was some sort of a mistake. I know I shouldn't have been so shocked.
40-17.
Exactly. Yeah, I thought there was something going on. A 17-point lead is a perilous one for this Leinster team. I know that. But in this case, they really did seem to be coasting. And I thought they would continue to do so. Would it shock you, by the way, to discover that the whole England 1950 typo story is actually bullshit?
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I thought I remembered hearing that was just total horseshit.
Well, you probably read the article by the buzzkills at the British newspaper archive, Murph, because they did a search a few years back and there was no mention anywhere of any 10-1 scoreline. The Western Morning News stated that England had lost against the 500-1 outsiders, having played poorly. England's manager, Walter Winterbottom, they reported, was said to have been sitting glumly in the stand. No shit. That bit's definitely true. Up in Scotland, the Aberdeen Journal stated, rather gleefully if you ask me, that it was pathetic to watch English football beaten by a side most amateur 11s would beat at home, and there was no fluke about it. So hold your horses there, Scottish journalists in 1950. You will have plenty of World Cup heartbreak to come in the next number of decades. But it seems like the 1-0, the 10-1 thing never actually happened.
But I mean, listen, when you think of USA 1, England 0, that totally apocryphal, and by apocryphal I mean untrue story, does, you know, it pops immediately into your mind unbidden. So, you know, it's when the myth becomes legend, print the legend, you know?
They did have better nicknames back then. Stanley Matthews, the magician, Tom Finney, the Preston Plumber. You know, great names like that. But Malachy Clerkin has done Leinster a service by giving Jemison Gibson Park a new nickname. Don't know if you read Murph,
really?
Peace, Murph. The Pigeon. So apparently a question was asked on QI a few years ago, why don't pigeons like movies? The answer is, if you'd care to hazard a guess before I...
No.
Pigeons would be Come on, you would at least give a guess to Ken's ridiculous questions. Pigeons would be bored stiff at the cinema because movies, as we know them, are shot at a speed of 24 to 25 frames per second. But a pigeon's eyesight is so far advanced of a human's that it would need 250 frames per second to be engaged by it. This is why you'll never hit a pigeon with your car, no matter how hard you try, says Malachy. Essentially, life presents to them in slow motion.
Speak for yourself, Clerkin.
Clerkin going around there trying to nail every pigeon inside. Essentially, life presents to pigeons in slow motion compared to humans, or at least compared to humans not named Jameson Gibson Park. Sorry, that the pigeon. Wow. At one stage, he's talking about the match and he goes, but the pigeon sees everything. And into the next amazing thing that Jameson Gibson Park.
I mean, I feel like, you know, pigeons get a bit of a bad rap. I mean, not as bad as the seagulls, but still pretty bad in this town. I don't think any person living in Dublin doesn't want to get called the pigeon.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you might like it. Jameson Gibson Park isn't going to like it, though.
Exactly. That's why it's going to stick. I mean, that's normally the case with nicknames, isn't it? Shane's on with the BBC's Chris Jones today for our one bank holiday podcast, Leinster, through to the final to play Toulouse at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Spurs fans may as well go and watch that one, as it's the closest they'll be getting to elite European competition. God.
Jesus on. Real lowest common denominator stuff out of you there.
He blew it, yes.
And I know what... Yeah, I know one particular Tottenham Hotspur fan who would not agree with that. He may even be appearing on this show today. That's Spurs lifer Shane Horgan. So.
Oh, yeah. That's fair. Ken will have a full football podcast for World Service members tomorrow, secondcaptains.com, £5 a month plus VAT. Michael Murphy and Paul Flynn will be on during the week for World Service members as well. Good fun in Salt Hill yesterday, I presume, Kieran?
Very, very good fun indeed, Owen. I was having a discussion with a fella last night, trying to decide whether this was the most fun we've had since Galway last won the All-Ireland. Beating Armagh on penalties in an All-Ireland quarter-final in Croke Park after there had been a massive 38-man brawl or whatever, I mean, that was fairly wild. But yesterday was... first of all, it was such a good game of football. But I only found that out last night after I'd gotten home after the drive and rewatched the entire thing all over again. Because during the game, you're kind of so emotionally invested in it that you're not actually sure whether it's any good or whether it's just kind of dramatic and close. But it actually was a very high-quality game. And
I
even
can tell
that,
you, Murph, watching it on TV, it was entertaining stuff.
Yeah, and I had this impression that the second half was a lot better. But actually, the first quarter was good as well. The quality definitely dropped in the second quarter all right. But for Galway to be 2 points down 2 minutes into injury time and to end up winning the game,
I suppose when you get given 17 frees in the last 5 minutes, you're probably going to get a fair chance of a comeback.
A lot of discussion about the frees, a lot of people getting very head up. I think the Conor Loftus one, what turned out to be the winning free from Conor Gleeson, I think that probably wasn't a great call, right? Other than the other ones, I think he actually got right, more or less. I would say that. I think that one is the one maybe that David Goff would rather have back. But I know that Kevin McStay was incredibly magnanimous after the game. Basically left us with the suggestion that if David Goff ref every single one of Mayo's games in the championship this year, he'd be happy. So I think that... Yeah, that is kind of instructive as well. But it was so dramatic. And, you know, you're kind of trying to figure out where the emotion came from at the end, whether it was just you win a game against any opposition in that fashion, that's going to be pretty enjoyable. The fact that it's Conor Gleeson who, you know, had his moments even yesterday, has had his struggles over the last couple of years. For me, I think he's been decent this year. The mistakes he made yesterday are mistakes that goalkeepers now make. Like, it's just that's just part of the pros and cons of it all. Was it the fact that there was, you know, silverware on the line? Is it tied more intimately to the idea of it being a Connacht final than maybe we even recognise in ourselves as fans, that it still has legacy cachet in that way? For whatever reason, all of those things probably, it all kind of combined to be one of just a really special day to be like a Galway football fan.
Well, poor choices. This is the whole... You, I guess even as a viewer, you're only as engaged by the fair on offer as the combatants are. And when you see how much it meant to the Mayo players to lose, and the Galway players, and particularly their manager who's done it all, how much it meant to him to win, then you're like, oh well, whatever about the provincial championships as a whole, this particular game I'm watching seems to matter quite a lot to everybody involved.
Yeah, exactly. And I think as well, I think Eamon Fitzmaurice, the eternally excellent on co-commentary, Eamon Fitzmaurice.
I
literally, I turned on the TV when I got home last night. I was like, oh, Fitzmaurice is on co-commentary. This is so good. I'm going to learn more stuff. That's brilliant. But I think it was him that said it kind of in the last 5 or 6 minutes when he was saying, you know, just that it was great stuff. And what one of the things that made it great was the arrival of these really recognisable characters onto the scene late on who were having an impact. So Killian O'Connor comes on for Mayo, Dermot O'Connor comes on for Mayo, Shane Walsh comes on for Galway, and they start to really have an impact on the game. Matthew Tierney comes on. So it's kind of like all these established names filtering back into the game in the last 20 minutes and really showing up big at various moments for their team. That was another extremely, and like for the floating fan, that's brilliant. Like, you know, for the floating, for the neutral, that kind of really lent itself to the drama as well, I think.
Who did you want to take that last free, by the way? Because the ball seemed to be thrown around a little bit. I don't know, was it outside Shane Walsh's range? I mean
it's not usually outside Shane Walsh's range, but he is rehabbing a groin injury at the moment, which is hampering his kicking off the ground. And anyone who's, you know, practiced or had to practice free taking off the ground or off the hand, you know, muscle injuries like that do massively limit how much you can practice. I would have been happy to see Shane take it, but I mean, Gleeson hit the first free that he hit really, really well, like just a lovely style about it. And as he's walking up the pitch, I actually turned to the person beside me and I said, this is actually no lose for Conor Gleeson now. This is a theory I've said to you before, but even with a guy like Gleeson, like no one, like he's not a free taker that Galway people have gotten used to over the course of the last couple of years. Go up there, have a swing at it. You've a chance to be a hero. If not, extra time, it's fine, you know. And if Gleeson was thinking that in that moment, and I think he said something similar to Joanne Cantwell on RT afterwards, then just go and hit it, you know. Like, it is a chance to be a hero. And then, like, the noise when it went over was just incredible. And when you've been in Salt Hill as many times as I've been, and the atmosphere has been fairly moribund, and there's a wind howling and rain and all the rest, to see Salt Hill the way it looked in the 30 seconds after Conor Gleeson had scored that point, it was incredible.
Paul, is Murph right to be laying low this week?
I think so. And I have to put this without sounding offensive to Galwegians. I just don't, I'm not a big Galway football fan. Like, so this is nothing against Galway, but I just find it very hard to love them over the last number of years in relation to how they play. I never feared them when we played against them. I don't think Galway would be able to live with Mayo. So that's Galway.
Are you giving Galway a chance then, Nush?
No.
We've played 40 minutes. There's going to be at least another play. Conor Gleeson is taking his time. There's going to be another kick out. All eyes on David Coldrick. Everybody wants to say the 40 minutes doesn't matter. We know the time is up. There was at least a 1 minute stoppage and the referee is going to play. Johnny Heaney is saying drive it out. We have to win one more, Galway. And if they win this kick out, it will be over. Gleeson drives it long. It's not. It's over. He's blown it up on 40 and 30 seconds. And Galway have won the game by 114 to 16 points.
It's going to be a Mayo decisive win for me.
It's 1998 all over again, as Galway came to the Cauldron to take on a team who'd beaten the two previous All-Ireland finals. Pádraig Joyce has beaten Mayo for the first time in his career. The All-Ireland finalists are heading to the back door in 6 weeks' time. Galway will meet Leitrim in the Connacht semi-final in a fortnight, and a match that probably should have been far more comfortable than it was has ended up in the bottom line, a famous victory for Galway.
It's going to be a Mayo decisive win for me.
He's already dead.
82,000 fans at Croke Park were enjoying what looked like a nice procession into the Champions Cup final. But then, as Rory O'Connor put it in the Irish Independent, Leinster were enjoying themselves so much they almost forgot to win the game. Shane, how are you?
Yeah, a little bit shaky after the weekend, but we're okay. We got through. We're on track.
Chris, great to chat to you again. How are you?
Yeah, brilliant to be here, guys. Good to chat to you. Just off the back of an epic weekend, I was in Dublin at Croke Park, flew to Toulouse on Sunday morning, then to Bordeaux, flew back this morning. So I'm a little bit bleary-eyed straight from the airport, but great weekend. Brilliant to be at both the semi-finals.
Yeah, amazing. Well, tell us what we want to hear first before we talk about the games themselves. What did you think of the occasion at Croke Park as a whole?
Yeah, it was a great occasion. It was a real sort of privilege to commentate there. I actually went to a game as a fan, watched Ireland-Wales in 2008 when Shane Williams scored a great try on the corner, and then Wales ran down the clock on the way to winning the Triple Crown, and then the Grand Slam they sealed against France. So it was cool to be there as a fan back then, but really special to be there for this game as a commentator and all the history that comes with the stadium. In terms of the noise, you know, Toulouse on the Sunday was a more raucous atmosphere, but that just might be because it's in France, and the way the French do club rugby is like nowhere else in the world, is it? So it's always going to be tough comparing atmospheres to what you get at a Toulouse game. But really enjoyed the occasion on Saturday, and yeah, I thought it was a fascinating game. At one point, it looked like Leinster were going to run away with it and win, you know, 40 points to 15 or something. And, you know, so Northampton weren't a million miles away at all from pulling off a famous heist. So lots to talk about off the back of the game as well as the occasion.
Just on the history on Croke Park and all that kind of stuff, how much of that were you trying to convey to your listeners on Five Live there?
Yeah, well, I think it was definitely a big part of the build-up, wasn't it? Given the way Northampton embraced it. And, yeah, you know, I'm not sure how England prepared, say, in 2007 for a game that, you know, was I wasn't there, but you just have to talk to people who were, and it was so laced with emotion that even if England maybe tried to prepare for it, you couldn't actually deal with it. It's one thing talking about what might come, another thing actually being able to cope with it. But I thought it was telling that Northampton made a point of saying, look, this is why Croke Park is special. This is why it's different. This is the emotional cultural connection. This is the history, and this is why it's a unique venue. So Northampton paying, you know, a lot of respect to the venue, a lot of respect to Leinster, a lot of respect to the occasion. So yeah, it was certainly part of our build up. You know, we did a preview chat with Mark Chapman on the day on Five Live, and most of it was about Croke Park, and Andy Reid, former footballer, was getting involved and talking about it as well. So yeah, it was something that kind of transcended the rugby itself, didn't it?
Was Croke Park a factor at all, Shane, in what happened on the pitch, both good and bad for Leinster?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It was such an intriguing game, and so as Chris pointed out there, it did look for a period that this was going to be a procession, and you know the way Leinster opened up, you know, after 15 minutes, you know, two tries to the good, both by James Lowe, and you thought, well, listen, we've seen this story before, and they are continuing on and kicking on after you know, a big performance against La Rochelle to get them into the semi-final. But, you know, well, Northampton didn't read the script, and sort of, you know, maybe, you know, Leinster were drinking the Kool-Aid a little bit. But whether Croke Park had a massive impact on it, I'm actually not sure. It felt, now listen, I wasn't there, but it felt as if it was slightly more, not quite sterile, but it certainly wasn't as feverish as you know, as it might have been. But I think there's an element of expectation there more than sort of any particular level of jeopardy, which only came into it quite late. So there was an expectation Leinster would win. There was a little bit of a feeling to me of, you know, let's be entertained, as it were. You know, it's your job, lies to make sure we enjoy this game and we get the kind of result that is expected. And then, you know, it wasn't until the last few moments when there was genuine jeopardy and nervousness that came in, which I think first came from the players, and then it was sort of almost imbibed by the crowd, and they gave it back. And I have to say, if Northampton had of, you know, kicked the goal to draw the game and it went into extra time, I'm not sure how convinced I would have been that Leinster would have come away with
that.
Where
did it all almost go wrong then, Shane, from the dominant position that they were in?
I think it's an issue that Leicester have had on sort of occasion, and we sort of most recently, I suppose, you know, a couple of times against La Rochelle, but not exclusive to La Rochelle, where there is a sort of a burst and there's an immediate emotional performance and or delivery of game plan in the sort of opening moments, and everything's looking great, and then there's a bit of sort of fallow time almost, you know, and things aren't going quite right. Even, you know, we got into the second half, you saw things were getting very loose by the time Lowe scored his third try, and we thought, you know, this is great. The actual game had got loose on both sides, and I don't mean loose in time of it was like really sort of loose open play, but it was sort of loose, and there was a huge amount of sort of 50-50 offloads going through. You know, there wasn't a sort of the structure that actually very often supports what Leinster want to do. So you know, and it never felt that maybe it felt a little bit like, you know, Leinster were going for a knockout punch as opposed to you know, playing the consistent, you know, controlled way that they can, and then to break down teams, and you know, that went on for a while, and it got scrappy, and then it was just a lot of mistakes, a lot of poor play.
George Furbank, Chris, said that he reckoned Leinster shut up shop for the last 20 minutes. Do you think that's accurate?
I do, yeah, and we felt that in commentary. Jameson Gibson-Park went to a kicking game on kind of 50, 55, 60 minutes, and I got the impression that if Leinster kept going through the phases and playing, especially with this offload game they seem to have introduced, I think they could have broken Northampton again and scored the try to properly kill off Northampton's spirit. And Northampton knew that if it was 17, one try takes it to 10 and then it becomes an interesting ball game. So I don't know if that's a tactical thing or a mental thing. Leo Cullen, I asked him about it afterwards, and he said, look, it's maybe human nature when you've got a big lead just to sort of play a bit of territory and say to the opposition, come on then, are you good enough to go from 60, 70 metres? And don't get me wrong, Leinster had a lot of joy with the contestable kicking game. You know, with Tommy Freeman being in midfield, I felt Northampton missed his aerial skills on the wing. But I do feel Leinster just gave Northampton an in with the way their energy level slightly dropped, maybe the fact they hadn't played for 3 weeks, maybe the fact that Gibson Park plays with this tempo that is so unbelievable, is it sustainable for 80 minutes? And maybe he has to just go through a period where he plays a bit of territory. But it was only 3 or 4 box kicks, but it was just a lowering of the tempo and intensity a bit by Leinster, which encouraged Northampton, and they're a good enough side to not need too many invitations. And I thought they played some fantastic stuff in the last 20, 25 minutes, but they will really rue how poor they were in the first half, the number of handling errors, their set-piece frailties, and the fact that they probably did all the things they said they cannot afford to do when you go to a place like Dublin and play a team like Leinster.
There was a number of, I think, factors that came in, and we won't know until the final or afterwards. Which of these is more telling? Listen, there was definitely a withdrawal of ambition. I think that's fair enough to say. I'm just wondering if it was, as you say, potentially because of a tempo. I think maybe and sort of fatigue. I think less likely. Is it one that comes with as a result of things not quite going right or not sticking, and we're saying actually let's reboot here for a moment and sort of stop trying stuff and let's play territory or certainly play possession and sort of grind them down? Well, if that was the case, they then didn't execute that sort of element of the game. Now the real question is, and this is the big danger potentially for Leinster, is it something else that we've touched on before? Is it a nervousness around when things aren't going quite right and all of a sudden there's this spectre? And maybe this, Owen, is where the Crow Park factor was, you know, did come into play, that there's a spectre of Northampton. We've started very strongly. We've played some brilliant rugby. We're well ahead on the scoreboard. Or are we? We're actually not. We feel as if we should be well ahead. And Northampton are only 2 scores away. And hang on a second, is there a chance we could potentially lose this? And that was, I think we spoke on the podcast last week about Northampton getting Leinster to the point in the game, if they could do it, where they've got a bit of a screw in their head and they're looking over their shoulder a bit. And we've seen that again. I hate on harping back to the La Rochelle games, but they're the ones that you really have to judge Leinster and look the traits of in those high pressured games against, you know, the best team in Europe. Which, as if, what were the factors,
feels like Leinster,
that cost Leinster in those games?
It feels like Leinster putting the screw in their own heads, though, almost more so than, because Northampton were bringing nothing much to the table for the first hour of that game.
Well, that's what I think. The certainly the first you know, the half, it wasn't, it was the first entire half and some of the second wasn't a factor at all. But when I said, when things weren't going quite right for Leinster and Northampton hadn't shaken them off, then I think that, I don't know, it's something, it sort of retracts the play, and it's a big danger for Leinster.
Chris.
Yeah, I think with what happened in those last two finals, that is going to be a big narrative going into the Toulouse game. We've just had a chat on our pod, Rugby Union Weekly, about, for a team like Leinster, with their resources, the way they're managed, the way they prioritise the Champions Cup and the way they're able to rotate, they need to be winning regular Champions Cup to kind of vindicate that strategy. And they've not won one since 2018. So you could argue that the pressure is really on them now to deliver a Champions Cup as close as they've got. And they stormed out the blocks last year in the final and lost. And they were brilliant for most of the game in Marseille, or certainly had the game in their control, didn't they, in Marseille 2 years ago. And it took a late La Rochelle try to break them and win the game. So going into this one, even though, look, it could be one of those tactics that if, say, they kept playing and they throw an intercept and Northampton score, we all go, oh, you've just got it. You're 20 points to 3 up. Play some territory. Come on, guys. This is knockout rugby. So it's kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't. It's just the fact that at 17 points, you would have put all the money in the world that Leinster would score next and run away with the game. And the moment Northampton got to within 10 with the Hendy try, you just saw them lift. And then, credit to them, their replacements came on. Tom James at 9 was good. Anchor Scott Young on the flank was good. Sam Matavesi found himself in open play. Juano Augustus came into the game massively in that second half as well. And Northampton all lifted, and they used all their experiences of going well in Europe this season and going well in the Prem and getting a winning culture. I just think there is going to be that little seed, maybe not in the Leinster players' heads and maybe not in their management heads, but maybe in the supporters and those of us who are neutral, saying, okay, they so often dominate teams. Their ball retention, their slickness of play, their shape, their offloading game now, their physicality on both sides of the ball, the way they win quick ruck ball but spoil opposition's ruck ball, it is second to none. But there's got to be a reason why they haven't won a couple of titles recently, haven't won a URC for 2 years, haven't won a Champions Cup for 6. Is it mental? It might not be, but that will certainly be something we'll talk about, because you felt they had Northampton on the ropes, they had them on the cliff edge and just weren't able to put them away like you felt they could have done given the way the game was going.
I think not playing is the biggest risk for Leinster. Now, I'm not saying, you know, there's a number of factors of why potentially they didn't, you know, inverted commas, play. We've seen opposition, they haven't been able to get the opposition, a ball off opposition before. We've seen huge pressure and anxiety from Leinster trying to sort of, you know, exit their own defensive area. But it is, for me, you know, the one thing that's kind of that is most damaging for Leinster, that they visibly stop playing in the way that they play at their best, and they contract. And, you know, often that coincides with a kicking game, which is the worst type of kicking game, is kicking when you have to kick as opposed to kicking when you should kick, if that makes sense. And that wasn't always the case on Saturday, but I do remember a couple of occasions, and I think, Chris, you sort of highlighted one of them. It was a ruck, you know, I think halfway inside the Northampton half to the side, and a box kick. Well, you know, Gibson Park put up a box kick. I was like, why are Leinster doing that? That is not what Leinster should be doing. Like, historically, that's the kind of play we've seen when there's been a bit of panic, or, you know, there hasn't been the control that you'd want. Now, you know, it wasn't a terrible kick, but it's not the option that, you know, works best for Leinster, I don't think. And as soon as Leinster stop playing and they resort to sort of a kicking game under pressure, you know, opposition teams smell that as well, and they exploit it.
Yeah, and I think what we've seen, guys, is however good a team you are, and Leinster are a great side, and Toulouse are a great side, and Ireland, the national team, are a great side, but as we saw at Twickenham, you put any team in the world under pressure, and they can do funny things, and they can go off script and make decisions they wouldn't normally make. And I think Twickenham was a great example of that. You put teams under pressure either physically or on the scoreboard, and they can start to not unravel, but they can start to go a little bit off their game. And you felt Harlequins for a few minutes there, 5-point gap in the Toulouse 22. Have they got the great Toulouse side a little bit on the run? Have they got the fans subdued? It can happen to anyone. The All Black side, the legendary back-to-back winners, they still can get beaten. So the great thing about this final is they are the two best sides. They're the two most successful sides in European history. They're both in their eighth final. That's a record. One's going for six, one's going for five. But we could talk all day long about their credentials, of which they've got a million, but both have got fallibilities and frailties as well, which you can imagine both sets of coaches are going to desperately try to unpick ahead of that final in 3 weeks.
And that's why, you know, we could be looking at an all-time great final, you know, because they're, what I'd say neither of these two teams is, although, you know, for 90% of the year, Leinster often looked like, and have done for a number of years, just looked like this machine, and that they just, you know, they just drill out, you know, wins after win, success after success. But we also know that there's this time of the year that there's a vulnerability about them. And, you know, Toulouse are the same. Toulouse are not just a winning machine. They're a team that can play at an extremely high level, you know, and they win the majority of their games. Of course, they're in the final. But, you know, as Chris said there was definitely, you know, a distinct vulnerability, you know, at, you know, in effect at home against in Harlequins, in a game that they were sort of expected to win and win easily. I spoke to Benjamin Kaiser during the week, and he just could not see a way where, you know, Toulouse didn't win that game very, very comfortable. And that was not the story of that game.
Yeah, just on Leinster, Shane, and some of those frailties you talk about, are the questions going to be re-asked now about Ross Byrne, and should we be doing that? I mean, everyone was bigging him up after the quarterfinals, but he missed a few kicks, which he can't really do. You know, it's got to be a staple of his game, is nailing all those kicks. And then there was that moment where he intercepts a ball and finds himself with a lot of open road in front of him that he did not want to pursue. It looked like he wasn't back in his pace in that moment.
Yeah, but, you know, listen, Ross Byrne's game is not about that, right? So, listen, that's, you know, could he have been a little bit more, I think, you know, sort of aggressive in the way he was running and, you know, sort of backed himself, he could, you know, potentially, but I wouldn't beat Ross Byrne up about that.
It just looks very stark, though. A moment like that just looks so obvious to anyone watching the game, if you didn't know anything about rugby. It's like, why isn't this guy running into... They spend all day looking for space and then one player gets it and then... Sort of turns the pass, it's right.
But
away.
That, but
he's never been famous for his pace, Ross Byrne. Yeah. It's not like, you know, he's not a quick guy. That's just the reality the situation.
Listen, there's enough, and listen, you can criticize Ross Byrne for a lot of stuff. That's, you know, he's not, you know, as you said, pinning himself, you know, as that is a key part of his game. Where you would have an issue is, you know, when you get Ross Byrne at 10, what you're looking for is, I want control, you know, and I want to actually be in the right areas of the pitch in the right ways. And that actually, that kind of key part that you would expect of his game, that has been the areas that when the pack hasn't been entirely dominant, or there has been sort of balls going on the ground, it's a bit scrappy, like it was at the weekend, that we didn't see that kind of same level of control that you'd want, or the structure. So, you know, that's where I think you could legitimately have a sort of, you know, a case against Ross Byrne. And I think, listen, it was right to say he played well in the last game, because he did. But at the same time, we always said, this is, you know, you need a bigger data set of him playing top games and under pressure, and not top games where you've got an armchair ride because your pack are absolutely destroying the opposition. That is, you know, there's a certain skill set that, you know, that's needed to you know, to deliver a team performance when you have that sort of an armchair ride. But there's another thing entirely when the pressure comes on, both in terms of the scoreboard or the lack of complete dominance from your forward pack. You know, a couple of missed kicks, you know, I wouldn't be too harsh. I think that's a very strong side of his game. You know, I wouldn't expect that. And actually, even when the pressure comes on, he has shown that he's got real resolve and real bottle when it comes to, you know, making, you know, key kicks. So again, that's not the side of the game that I would be overly concerned about of Ross Byrne. The other elements of the game, and, you know, maybe the fact that he isn't what I would see as a traditional sort of super attacking, a big threat at number 10 for Leinster, That's a different matter entirely.
Yeah. I mean, is it Rogers' comments obviously last week in the Examiner column were interesting, talking about focusing the strategy around Ross Byrne, how he could derail Leinster through him. He goes on to say Ross Byrne had a great game and my players were kind of looking at me going, what are you talking about with this guy? That said, I would still go with the same plan if we're going at Leinster this weekend. So is that something Toulouse be going after Ross Byrne, Chris, or is that just something that every team is always going to go after an opponent's out half regardless of the situation?
Yeah, they will, and regardless of how great a fly half is, they'll still be targeted by the opposition. That's just the fact of it. But the jury is out on whether Ross Byrne can win a Champions Cup. We know that Johnny Sexton can win a Champions Cup. He's won a handful. We know that there was this long-running narrative about who was going to be Johnny Sexton's successor as the Ireland number 10. And the fact he went to 38, he was still playing really well, don't get me wrong. But there was always a little bit of a clearly a concern about who was going to be Sexton's backup, and was that backup ready to follow in Sexton's footsteps to anywhere near the same level. Ross Byrne, you know, is a really, really good player. There's a huge amount of respect for him, I think, across European rugby. But because of what's happened the last couple of finals, and especially last year with Sexton being unavailable, Byrne wasn't quite able to get Leinster over the line. And that's just the question that's going to dog a few of these Leinster players until they go and win the Champions Cup. Now, a lot of them have the benefit of winning titles with Ireland, which really settle any concerns about them being a title-winning group of players. We know they are, without doubt. But I think for Ross Byrne personally, he would love to spearhead Leinster to a Champions Cup just to say, look, I am out of Johnny's shadow. I am good enough to do this. Because not every fly half is. It's a huge thing. It's a huge achievement to go and win a Champions Cup. It's the highest level of club rugby, and it's as close to Test rugby as you'll get when it's the club game. So I just think it'd be, from a personal point of view, it would just be great for Ross Byrne to just beat Toulouse, get over the line and say to everyone, yeah, I'm a title winning number 10, which at the moment he can't quite say yet until he goes and does it.
What did Leinster do right in the first half then, Shane, when you consider we've spent most of this podcast kind of outlining how they nearly balls this one up?
It was a very Leinster type performance, wasn't it? You know, it was tempo, fastball, and more the same. With the odd loop play thrown in to boot. The interaction between fours and backs, is probably the hallmark of when Leinster are playing at their best, and you see a first receiver, forward, very often Tadhg Furlong, pulling that ball back around to the second wave that comes around the corner, but still holding the inside line as well. So it's kind of what you would have expected. I don't think there was a huge amount of difference from the best type of Leinster performance we've seen before. It wasn't sort of radical overhaul in those moments, but I think we have seen this sort of slightly change, relatively significant change in defence, and that might be the interesting sort of story of this championship, and might be the interesting story of the game in a couple of weeks' time, because I think we kind of all universally, or maybe not universally, but a lot of people have said, right, new defensive system, this is a better system for Leinster, and it's what Leinster should be doing, and it's going to win them the championship. And I'm actually not 100% certain if that is right. The case. There's elements of it, certainly, that a really aggressive defensive line where you're really sprinting into that first zone, and you're challenging the opposition to move the ball wide. At certain times and against certain opposition, that can be very that I think is works brilliantly, but I think there's also this, a relatively significant risk again with that as well. The risk for Leinster are that this is where they're kind of more up and in, as opposed to just up really, really hard. Where they're up and in, and we saw a number of times, and we saw it got exploited a number of times. They're not like, I suppose they're only 6 months or less, probably, or however many sessions it is, into taking that system on board. Secondly, I think that's a trickier system to deliver during these months of the year where you've got faster tracks and handling is easier. And you know, the ball is easier to move into those wide channels. And then the other sort of risk is the opposition you're playing against. And maybe that was a factor in the game at the weekend, that when Northampton got going, you could see why, you know, they're top of the Premiership and sort of tip to win it, because and seen as the bright young things of moving the ball wide, because they had some joy there. Now, you know, Leinster are going to be playing Toulouse in a couple of weeks, and we saw. Harlequins come up hard a number of times, especially in that sort of opening half, and get, you know, roundly exploited by it.
Yeah, and I think that the most fascinating thing when you have a team defending like this, we've seen it with the Springboks, and we've seen it with England bringing in that sort of Springbok system in their Six Nations, is who can beat the blitz, and when you beat the blitz, can you execute? And Northampton beat it once in that first half, didn't they? But the pass from Furbank to Ram went just behind on the stroke of half time, and I think that could be big occasion nerves from Northampton. I think in the Premiership they walked that in. It's up a level at Croke Park in front of 80,000. They snatch it a bit because they know they're behind on the scoreboard and under pressure. But with players like Paul Cost, I mean, this kid from Toulouse, this 21-year-old outside centre who is scorches across the turf, going forward with the ball in hand, he's going to cause carnage going forward in a France and Toulouse shirt. So can he get into a channel where they just beat that man rushing in? And that's going to be so interesting. Will Toulouse come up with set piece plays? Will they be more accurate than Northampton? Almost certainly. So yep, these rush defenses that have sort of been modeled by the South Africans and introduced to other rugby teams as their coaches move on, are bringing this level of intensity. They're shutting down defenses. They're, you know, Finn Smith a couple of times forced to check inside when he probably would have wanted to go wide, but occasionally you could beat it. And then once you do beat it, can you make it count? And Northampton will rue not doing that at the end of the first half. Toulouse, you feel, would take those opportunities.
I know you've both been critical of Jameson Gibson-Park's decision-making later in the game, but a couple of words of praise, Shane, for his contributions to the first two tries in particular. I mean, the first one was just a lovely bit of vision and then execution of the pass, quick thinking, and the second, more instinctive, just ball comes to him, and rather than catch it like probably a good few other players would have done, he just bats it on almost volleyball style out to low.
Yeah, listen, he's having the kind of season that wins you a European Cup. That's what it feels like, isn't it? You know, was he a man of the match? Although if I scored three tries in a European Cup semi final, I might be having a word
couple
in
of
someone's ear.
In fairness, yeah.
Yeah, well, listen. It's the winger.
Pick your audience here, Chris.
For sure.
I might be having a word, but listen, Gibson Park has just been, you know, consistently sort of, you know, excellent. Very, very core to what Leinster deliver. Feels like, you know, a Jameson Gibson Park team as now, as opposed to a Sexton team, if that makes sense, you know. And it's sort of maybe what we've seen traditionally more from French teams, and what we'll see in a couple of weeks with Dupont at nine, despite having, you know, a rock star number 10. It's, you know, it's a more nine focused sort of, you know, structuring of the game, and we're seeing that very much with Gibson Park. You know, consistent tempo. And I've said this on more than one of times in this on this podcast. You know, there's a lot of factors in tempo, getting tempo into the game, including how the, you know, the ball, where in the pitch you are, how the ball carrier carries the ball, what the sort of footwork, you know, meters, what sort of meters on contact, you know, who's cleaning out, how efficient they are, and then how quickly the nine gets the ball away. But, you know, somehow Gibson Park can sort of inspire those other elements to the game. I don't know, they get to a higher level when he's on the field. They're not quite as good when he's not. And that's quite a remarkable thing. Now, it is sort of, you know, part of the same sort of continuum, in that when he moves the ball fast away from a ruck, you know, the next player who's carrying is naturally coming onto the ball, and this makes everything slightly easier. But it is the kind of the key element, not just to Leinster play, but there's very, very few teams that don't have success, or that have success by having slow ball. You know, it's just a key part of the game, and he is instrumental to Leinster gathering that. Now, that's beyond, as you said, their own, the sort of key moments of sort of intelligence and skill as well. So I love that first try in particular. So you had the two elements of him sort of identifying that, and there was plenty of numbers around Northampton. You know, they weren't all, you know, we've seen those tap quick and goes before. It's because everyone's in it, like, you know, a bunch, or everyone's has turned their back. not everyone had, but there that but it was on where it was on. So he had the intelligence to make that decision, identify where it was, and then it was an absolutely exceptional pass to put it into low as well. So all those sort of factors combining were sort of a demonstration of all the good things about Gibson Park. And you do feel that he's the kind of, you know, he's having the season that, you know, people will look back, and if Leinster win it, they'll say, oh, that was the Gibson Park season, almost. And
I would just say he's walking on water. That tap and pass, kind of, we were, you know, looking at a great view of it from our high vantage point. It was always looping, and you thought, oh, someone's got to pick this up from Northampton. You know, if you're not in that kind of form, A, you don't go for it, and B, you don't execute it. You know, your pass is a bit off, and someone snatches it, and everyone blames you for turning down a three or a scrum or a great attacking opportunity. So he's in amazing form. He's the Lions 9 if it was picked tomorrow. And when you talk about the criticism of the way the game plan changed in the second half, it's more the fact that when Gibson Park is fizzing and moving the ball, Leinster just looks so dangerous. So it's almost because he's playing so well, when you do see him playing more of a containment strategy, you wonder why. But look, that's probably a bit idealistic, and I'm sure there are reasons that go into it. And we've spoken about playing territory and winning a tight knockout game and respecting territory and the opposition and all that. But yeah, when he's fizzing and Leinster are fizzing, everything's coming through him. They're playing at such speed, and he's just in unbelievable nick at the moment.
DuPont was fizzing yesterday as well, though, wasn't he, Chris?
Yeah, and we just had a chat just now with Danny Kerr about who the best nine in the world is, because James Lowe said it was Gibson Park, and, you know, obviously James Lowe's going to back his mate, and you could make the argument that DuPont's the best rugby player in the world and Gibson Park's the best number nine, but DuPont had a quietish game, and he scored two tries and made a crazy line break and cleared brilliantly, and he plays like another flanker, because the amount of, even when you spoil to lose his ruck ball, he shakes off the players that are coming through and threatening to turn you over. And I think we saw that so starkly in the Six Nations, that maybe bits like that we miss when we went, oh, Luku's in good form for Bordeaux. France have a great pack. They've got great backs. They'll be fine. You miss the fact that Ireland put such pressure on France's ball in Marseille on the opening night, and Luku couldn't exit. DuPont can exit off either foot with serious distance. He can kick 50 metres with either foot. And it's little bits like that that maybe you take for granted amidst the line breaks and amidst all the brilliant play and all the tries. So what a head-to-head weeks' time. Yeah. Man, whoever gets the better of that, we'll know they're getting great ball. And it goes to Shane's point about it being the whole team effort. But whoever is on top, DuPont, Gibson Park, you know, their team is winning the game.
But what DuPont does... and he has such a threat around the breakdown, and you can see in his mind's eye, he very often goes back the way the ball is coming from. So you would see when there is a tackle, the ruck, the way it's, the defensive system is formed around it, is generally now teams are racing to get to the open side, because so they're showing numbers around the corner. So it used to be that you would, without doubt, they would, either side of the ruck, what we call the two pillars, they would be the first ones to post up, and that you would fix that first, because if you bleed there, if anyone runs through those gaps, you're in big trouble. But what we're seeing a little bit now from teams is, actually, we might send two over on the open side first and then plug in here, because it's less of a threat. But DuPont is always looking for that. And so that is going to change maybe slightly the way sort of Leinster defend. But even if they are posting up on either side of the ruck first, what the other thing we'll see is, he is such a threat around there. And as Chris spoke about, that sort of flanker-type strength, where he sort of always carries a couple of people with him, it seems, over the gain line, and he can get his hands away, and he's wriggling. He's a nightmare to tackle. So what you're going to have is a slightly compressed defensive system around that ruck, purely for him. So he doesn't have to do anything to make Toulouse much better and to make Leinster change the way. He doesn't have to do one. He doesn't have to make one break at the in the final. That will already be there because of his history and his backlog and work, and that screw that will be Leinster's head. Because they're going, if we miss that once in one tackle, he's going to pick it, and they'll be right, and he will. So he doesn't necessarily have to pick it, and if Leinster might never make a mistake in that area during the game, but what happens is it means that they're tighter at ruck time, and that means there has to be space somewhere else. And then you when you combine that with the fact that actually the Leinster defence might be a bit more narrow anyway because of the system, the new defensive system, then there may be quite a bit of space out wide. It's a challenge to how do you get the ball out there.
Yeah. What about the challenge of the next couple of weeks before this, Shane? Leo Cullen says he's going to be picking strong teams for the URC now. Is that the right call?
I don't know, actually. It depends on they will have a lot of data on how these players are travelling. You know, so what miles have they done? You know, who's done it for Leinster? Who's done it for Ireland? And again, as we spoke about before on this podcast, the sort of balancing the cadence of the season to peak in the final. I think they've pinned their colours to the mask. I think it is still about this. I know what Leo has said that, but it is the European Cup is the only thing that matters. So, whatever they need to do in order to peak for that game, that's what they'll do. It won't be any consideration of any other games. For example, I think when we won it in 2009, I remember we had the lightest training. I think I've ever really, had in my life beforehand, and it was almost a kind of a nervousness about it. We didn't do a tap. The weather was so great. I remember we would be literally just having run throughs, very very little contact, but run through very very short sessions, and that was exactly the right thing to do because a long season, there was a lot of miles on clock, and Cheka had a sort of confidence that it's not actually in many ways about dotting every I and crossing every T. You have to sort of trust that sort of the work that you've done through the full year for that. And it's actually then just about having bodies in the right shape. Now, that may mean, as I said, some players having a couple of games, but if that's not the best thing for them to do, they won't do it.
Mm. And then you've got Toulouse, who have two massive top 14 games. They're second in the top 14, but that is obviously so important to them. Not the URC isn't to Leinster, but the history around Toulouse and that tournament, they'll be doing everything to be getting home playoffs and then to win the top 14. I think they've got Stade Francais at home and Montpellier away on the weekend before. So just the different ways the management plan their squads, just a Pont rollout for those two, and Tamac, still getting a lot of rugby back in him after a long injury layout. Just going to be really interesting how they manage it from here on to Tottenham.
I think they will manage it though. I think if they win at home, they might sacrifice away. They're able to do that because of the position they're in. I don't think there's a huge a massive difference here in terms of run in. You're right.
They've got a gap. You're right, between them and Bordeaux. Yeah. They've got a buffer between second and third. Yeah.
So I think they'll use it. If circumstances were different. And they were forced to put the full team out, they would. But two things that are at their advantage. One, they do have that, as you said, slight buffer, but also as well, they do have they have an extremely deep squad as well. So both those factors, I think, mean that they won't be, it won't be a huge difference between the way Leinster and Toulouse prepare for the final.
Shane is our celebrity Spurs fan on the World Service roster. Sorry for your troubles. It's like Champions League football is not on the way this year.
It's beyond us. It's beyond us. But the stadium is beautiful. That's what I mean.
That's how they all say.
That's the real quiz.
God, we're Champions League stadium team.
Shane, brilliant stuff. Thanks a million. Thanks so much, Chris. Great stuff.
Thanks for having me. Cheers, guys.
Thanks a million, man. Cheers.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like, what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Second Captain Show. Second Captain Show.
It's the best thing in the world for you because it's full of protein. Protein.
This is not a dig at football people who know the game.
No respect, no honour.
Put your respect on my name.
Dog shit is bad, aren't
they? But who plays rugby?
I imagine it was like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
No, they don't.
They
no.
do.
Sorry, on. They do not.
And the balls.
Shut up, the two of you. I just want to play commentary at a goal.
Far up and I go.
English dance.
Work, you can hang us.
Work, you can hang us.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like Nick.
You get the ball forward, you compete, you chase people, you close people down, you create excitement, you win balls when you shouldn't win balls, you commit yourself to the game.
Rashida Adeleke is running herself into some half-decent form with the Olympics around the corner, isn't she? Last night in the Bahamas, she led the Irish mixed 4x400m team to a bronze medal at the World Athletics Relays. Running the second leg, her split time was 48.45 seconds. That's the fastest ever recorded at this event, and faster on the night, more pertinently, than the these women were all running, the current Olympic 400m champion, the current world 400m champion, and the current world indoor 400m record holder. They're all competing in the race. And Adeleke went faster than all of them. This was also after racing hard twice on the Saturday when she had taken out six runners on her leg in the heats before then having to, I don't know if you saw this, but she had to weave her way across the track. This is in the heats to hand the baton to Thomas Barr. Barr had been placed on the outside, in the outside lane. He apparently should have been on the inside. So she's heading that way. And then suddenly it's like, oh no, I have to weave across and add an extra 5 or 10 meters onto this run that I'm doing. But Barr did his job, as did Adeleke and the rest of them. We've talked about this before. It's such, I should say also that Adeleke helped the women's 4x400m team qualify for the Olympics. So the women's 4x400, the mixed 4x400, they both qualified on the Saturday. And then on the Sunday, the mixed team won the bronze. Adeleke didn't compete for the women's 4x400 in the final. So they probably, with that, probably won any chance of a medal. But at the same time, it's such a great event to watch. Carl Dennehy says the heats and the final are going to take place on the opening weekend of the athletics program at the Olympics in Paris. This is of the mixed relay. So this is one to watch out right at the start of the athletics series in Paris. The mixed relay is going to be on. There's only one day of rest before the first round of the women's 400 metres, though, the following day. So, as he says, they'll be hesitant to go into that carrying fatigue. Also, if any Irish woman makes the individual 400 metres final, which we hope and presume Adeleke will, they'll be unavailable for the heats of the women's 4x400, which take place earlier the same day. So, long story short, precisely how involved Adeleke is going to be able to be in all these relays in Paris is not entirely clear. And I don't want to jeopardise for one moment her individual chances, but these relays are so exciting to watch, and our teams are shit hot with her in there. We kind of have a chance of a medal in these if she's able to run them. Yeah. So I just absolutely love to see that.
It would be a lot of fun to see us with a relay,
completely
Olympic medal. How
it just seems so big time, doesn't it? It always you know, it's the USA and Jamaica and all these big hitters always dominating things. Yeah. And for us to be in amongst that company would be a lot of fun in the Olympics. So we'll see what happens there. Thanks, Ciarán.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Thanks for listening today. We'll hopefully see you during the week on the World Service. If you want to sign up, the episodes will be ad-free in that case. It's secondcaptains.com is the place to have a look. The Second Captains podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
What's going on, is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well,
HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.